Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the latest episode of our brand new spin-off show, The Interviews, where we collect all our lovely chats with film folk into one handy place every week. With the exception, of course, of one interview, which will be over on the Mothership Empire podcast out on Friday. From now on, we're hoping that Wednesday will be where the show lives, to give it a little extra breathing space and to set it apart from the main show, but that will be open to scheduling. Last week, for example, two of the interviews we did for The Interviews took place on Thursday, so our hands were tied there. Anyway, that's enough scheduling nonsense for me. You don't want to hear this stuff. You want to hear who's on this week. And we have some belters, folks. We're going to start off with one of this year's Oscar nominees for Best Actress, the wonderful Rose Byrne, whose extraordinary performance as a mother going through the mother of all existential crises in If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You has rightly been garnering all kinds of praise, nominations, and awards. As someone who's followed Byrne through her career since her appearance in, yes, the five-star Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, through her pivot to comedy with the likes of Bridesmaids and Spy and the Bad Neighbors movies, or Neighbors if you're listening to this in the States, and turns in the likes of X-Men First Class, the Insidious films, the TV show Damages, and many, many more, it is great to see her finally being given her flowers with this fearless performance in Mary Bronstein's film. Rose was in town at the weekend just after the film's release over here and ahead of the BAFTAs, and she was gracious enough to jump onto Zoom with me for nearly half an hour, talking about If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, the differences between comedy and drama, working with Conan O'Brien, who is in the film and is excellent in the film, motherhood, and much, much more. Oh, another great thing about the interviews is that we can run longer interviews pretty much in full, so you're going to get most of this, and maybe even all of this. So here you go, Rose Byrne talking about If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. Oh, and by the way, we do talk about the film's key moments, so maybe listen to this one after you've seen the film. Just a heads up. Enjoy. Hey, Rose, how's it going?
I'm good, how are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for taking time out on a Saturday. Should be your day off.
Yeah. I know. No, it's good. I'm so thrilled the film has a release here. And this is really like the last sort of release, you know, for now that we're pushing for the film. So it's been, I feel the Brits really understand the humor in the movie. It's been lovely to sort of hear the reception and how they really understand the comedy. Has been kind of delightful.
There's so much to talk about with this movie. I've seen it described in so many ways. I've seen the words horror film bandied around with regards to If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. But yeah, it's a comedy as well at its heart. There are so many scenes that just make me laugh so hard. There's the hamster scene, of course, which I'd love to talk to you about because that little guy, we never knew him.
It's such a wonder. It's almost a comedic set piece. I mean, it's obviously, it's very dark humor, which I think is why it plays well in the UK. But in the screenplay, the hamster was described as Jack Nicholson from The Shining trying to break through the wall. And I immediately read that and I was dying. I thought, oh, good Lord, this is hysterical.
How did they do that? How did you do the hamster scene?
We had a puppeteer who built this hamster and was such an artist, made this incredible little character, and then we had a real hamster. So, you know, you can imagine the characters on set. There's a puppeteer, there's a couple of puppeteers, and there's the animal wranglers, who are always very interesting people, and then the actual animal. So it was, and then a child. We had Delaney Quinn on set. So, and it was shot in various, it was one of those sequences where you're in various locations for the one sequence. So it was a technical feat, really was. It was ambitious.
It was ambitious, but again, it's very, very funny. And there's a lot of stuff in this movie that is very, very funny. There's the scene where Linda is screaming into the phone in the middle of a shop, and then goes up to the counter and asks for Visa gift cards as if nothing has happened, which again just tickled me immensely.
I know that it's. She's very disciplined with the tone because it's so tense, and then she knows to keep the Mary Bronstein, my writer director. She knows to let out the tension, so it's this tension, and you have to have relief to keep the audience with you, and that's through the humor. I think also through the scenes with James, ASAP Rocky's character. Yeah. They're very like a relief because he's so warm and charismatic. And finally, she's like, you're allowed to relate to someone who seems like a normal person. And It's very tightly disciplined film. It's a tight machine.
But that scene, I think, really sums up your experience as an actor on this movie in so many ways, because you are incredibly emotionally tense and fraught in the beginning of that scene, and then you are controlled and buttoned down, or trying to be controlled and keeping things buttoned down in the same shot. And that seems to be a lot of Linda's experience on this movie, and I'm guessing a lot of your experience as well.
Yes. But also, like, wildly fun and challenging for an actress or anyone, you know, to get a gift like this role where you get to do these huge kind of pendulum swings. And, you know, the trap with this character is that it could be one note. You know, she's sort of like hysterical the whole time, and that's like, there's nothing, you know, what's more dull. So it was trying to always find the nuance of the humor and but those dips of moments where she could have less hostility and then ramp it up more. So it was always trying to find the nuances in that, so it didn't have fall into that kind of trap.
It's an interesting thing, because you shot this movie in, I believe, September and October of 2023. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So that means, I'm guessing, that the script first came your way a few months beforehand?
Correct. So I met with Mary in 22.
Oh, wow.
And she waited for me. I had a final season of a show I did on Apple called Physical, and I finished that. And then the strike happened, so we had to wait for that, and then we got to shoot. So it was really a wild ride that she finally got this film made. And she had been pushing it for 8 years to get it made as well, before I came on board. And then now we've obviously been on the road with it for a year, because we premiered at Sundance a year ago. Yeah. And it's been shepherded really beautifully by Picture House here in the UK and A24 in the States. So I've had great partners in doing that, but I've never had this experience before with a film, so it's been really cool.
So let's go back to the beginning then. So this first meeting with Mary, did you know what you were meeting about, or had you read the script before you first met Mary? What was the time frame?
I read the screenplay and devoured it. It was very parallel to the film, the tone of it, the pace of it. The very disorienting, like not knowing where you were, like it's very ahead of you and
what's reality, what's not, that sort of thing.
What's not, like very, very dark humor. So I was in, I thought, oh my goodness, what a gift this it would be. And I don't want to fuck this up. And what do I do now? And so I met with her and she was so candid and, you know, explained where it came from and her experience. And we just started to have a conversation, and then I was like, I would be honored to try to bring this to life, and I couldn't believe that it had come my way. You know, this is, you can never anticipate in this business how something will be received and what will come your way or anything like that. But I knew it was an extraordinary screenplay.
Was there a moment that made you think, okay, yeah, I could do this?
No, God, no. I didn't know if I could do it. I was like, I'm going to try, but I'm going to give it 1,000%. Well, I don't know if I could pull it off. Are you kidding me?
What was the scene that you thought you might not be able to do?
All of it. The character is the film, and the film is the character. So how I had no concept of how to even begin, but just begin at the beginning. And we had, which I've spoken about, but we had a, she's very driven by performance, Mary Bronstein, too. She studied as an actress. So, you know, and I'm driven by storytelling as well. You know, how do we tell this story and what, you know, and also I was obsessed with who this character was before we meet her and why is she responding like this in this crisis. It's very different to how I, Rose, would respond. So it was just fascinating to try to tap into that and unlock that. We had a period of about 5 weeks where I would go to Mary's apartment and we would just be sat at her kitchen table 3 days a week, combing through the script, just combing, really like preparing for a play almost, discussing backstory, present day, like everything, sharing our own stories of motherhood. So this was a wonderful dialogue we had before we got to set. We spoke to mothers who have children with special needs. We did breath work with the woman in the movie who's doing the holotropic breath work. So I spoke to a therapist. It was great. It was an immersive, all-round experience. And everyone's, you know, this is all actors' homework. You don't necessarily want to hear about it, but, and everyone's different. Some actors don't want to rehearse. They don't want to have any conversation. Everyone is so personal how people approach this, but for Mary and for me, we really worked the same way. So.
Well, I am fascinated by actors' homework, and it is something that I ask a lot of actors on this podcast. I ask about preparation and first days and first shots. And I know that the first shot of this movie was literally the first shot of this movie. And it establishes the film's MO and Mary's MO in such a way. The camera is right in your face, pretty much as close as the laptop camera is right now to your mm-hmm. face. Closer. Maybe even a little closer.
Way closer.
Way closer. Okay. So, and you've
and
done
I didn't
all
have this lovely filter that I have on my face either, or this gorgeous hair and makeup that my team have put me in.
And you weren't in a lovely armchair in a London hotel either.
In a fancy hotel with sparkling water.
But at that point,
but the first day, was that first shot. To your point,
How do you get into that mindset, Linda's mindset at that juncture? How can you use everything that you've learned up until that point, but also I guess keep it to one side so you can live in the moment? How does that all work?
No, you can't. I mean, to your point, you have to throw it out the window, because once you're on set, nothing can be really decided upon until you have the other actor in front of you. It's acting is reacting. So it can only take place in the moment. It's my sacred moment too, between action and cut. That's mine. Like, no one can take that away. That's my special moment too. But it's such a collaborative thing, making a movie. You need the prop person to have this here. You need to know where the camera, that person has to get the focus right. You have to make sure the light is, it's like, it's a truly collaborative experience. And also, my focus has to be so laser sharp on what I'm doing in the moment. So it's a wild exercise every time you do it. And I never know if it's going to work or not. And sometimes it's a total failure. So that first day though was the hardest day. And also because I was in a scene with Mary, the director. So she's playing Dr. Spring in the movie. So we're also acting opposite one another. And we're establishing this language with the camera. And it's so you already have first day nerves, and then also figuring out tonally the where the character is in her crisis, like how hard do we go, how much do we push this, and trying to give options, I think, is a gift that I can provide the director as much as I humanly can. Is it's going to be decided in the edit. They're going to figure out what it's a director's medium, so how can I come in with my point of view on it, but also to give options, nuanced, try to give options of this, so they know when they're piecing this big puzzle together, they have choices. Mm.
Is that something that comes from, over the last few years, you've done a lot of comedy and a lot of comedy with an improvisational bent as well. So is that something that you've, I sort of string to your bow, that you've added over the years in terms of being able to give people options and play within
That's
takes?
A great question. I think comedy is a great discipline in that. I do. I feel like you have to, and also comedy is the stakes have to be so high. For me anyway, it's the same as a drama, except on top of that, you have to get a laugh. So the stakes have to be really high for it to land and to mean something and have a tragic comedy quality to it. So it's very precious, the joke. It's a high, and obviously it's different sorts of humor, like the broader comedies I've done, it's a very different style, whereas this is obviously very character driven and situational. But I think that it all informs, everything you've done informs you in the moment. So it's all the detritus of that. Is that the word? Is that how I'm pronouncing it correctly? That is all, I think, sits in you, whether you're conscious of it or not. And I don't think I am you're not particularly conscious of it, but it's all of those characters and all of those directors and experiences lead you to the moment that you're in now, And so, and like I say, a lot of the thing with comedy too is mostly you're failing. Mostly it's not funny. Mostly it's not working. And it's hard. That's why I think for me, it's a lot harder.
Is it hard in the movie as well? just go off on a quick tangent with comedy, because you've done a lot of improv in the past with people like Paul Feig and Seth Rogen, of course, and Nick Stoller, and crews are by definition not allowed to laugh. So how do you know when you're landing?
That's a great question. You know, I mean, we laugh on set, like Seth, you know, Seth will like, I, or, you know, the, yeah, the Neighbours movies or Bridesmaids or Spy or the bigger comedies I've done, you break and you laugh. But even then, you don't know if it's going to be funny in the edit. Like even then you think, oh, maybe this might be a little bit funny. Like we're laughing. It could very well not be fun. You know, you don't know how it's actually going to land in the edit. But I early on, I would laugh and laugh and I had to pull myself together because it is dull for the crew when you're just like, whoa, I laugh. And they're like, okay, can we please get on, get on with the day. But Seth always makes an interesting point about comedy. Because comedy is more subjective, like what I think is funny, you might not think it's funny. Whereas if something's sad, we can all agree it's sad. And that is why comedy's harder to capture, no? Because it's like, I don't know, it's way more subjective.
Yeah, it's long been a soapbox subject of mine on this podcast.
Look, I could talk about it all day. I'm a nerd about that stuff. And I still, you know, I learnt on these sets from these extraordinary comedic actors, from Melissa and Kristen and Seth. And so I feel I'm a student of theirs, and I feel like, and that would, I'd be like, I would say that to Kristen and she would like laugh at me or, you know, but it's true. I was schooled in this incredible school of comedic actors. You know, I was so lucky.
But with Linda then, for example, because Mary obviously knows his character inside and out, so how were you able to play within the lines that she had conjured up?
That's a great question. So there were some scenes that we discovered moments of improv, but very little. It was very true to the screenplay, but there were some scenes where to move it along, we needed to push things in a certain way, and I would I think one scene at the motel when the tension sort of rising and it was back and forth and we needed to drive it a little more. So we started to improv through the end of the scene, and that I think helped in the pace. So there were moments, but I really leaned on her. I was like, I would ask 1,000 questions and, you know, and I became a little bit paranoid, like the character. At the end of the day, I'd ask her 1,000 more questions. Did we get this? I was so wary of making sure I was doing my job. I just was, I was on the edge of my seat the whole time, much like Linda a little bit, even though I'm very church and state, but I think it does seep in a little bit when you're doing it.
And of course, you know, you're not playing Mary. It's inspired and influenced by her own experiences. But did you bring any of your own experiences to bear on Linda as well?
I feel you know, knock on wood, I've not had this experience, and most parents won't with their child. But the nature of the relentless nature, I think, of parenting is inherent and universal, and that is something I feel any parent can relate to. And also, you know, I've talked so much about the harder aspects of parenting, but it's also like so empowering being a parent, and so it's the greatest role of my life, and it's a gift, and you know, all of those wonderful things. But this film is about, it's really about the experience of the mother. And also I think the fact you don't see the daughter, which we've talked about, is a big conceit, you know, because when a child comes on screen, your empathy, as it should, goes with the child. And so to be focused entirely on the mother is a big conceit, big swing. But it lends itself so much to this claustrophobic nature that the film is employing to tell the story.
Absolutely. You say, of course, Rose, that, you know, being a mother is the greatest role of your life, but that role is entirely improv, right?
it confronts all your limitations, all of your limitations as a person. It's wild how that and how it changes too and evolves, and all the corny, all the cliches, all of it. It's all true. How much you have to reflect back your, what you need to work on as a person to try to fulfill the role, you know, and do the best, you know, version of yourself you can.
Yeah. It would be nice to have a script though, I'm guessing, as well, for someone just to go.
I'm constantly looking for a script and constantly asking other parents, how do you do this? And what happens when you do this? And what do you guys do? Like, I'm always asking and searching, and I couldn't believe it when you become a parent. It's like you've gone to the moon and nobody told you. Oh no, you're going to go to the moon. It's a, no one told you?
It's a piece of piss. Come on, what are you doing? I want to ask about working with Conan O'Brien on this.
Oh, I know. Yeah. So how well known is he, can I ask you, to audiences here in the UK?
Well, I don't know that his show was necessarily ever on here, but I think for comedy nerds like me, yes.
Yeah. So for anyone in comedy, he's a legend. He is a legend. And he's wonderful. He's the opposite of his character. It genuinely is. He's a very empathic guy. He's very personable. He's wildly supportive. He's become sort of a life coach for me and Mary Bronstein. He's so glass half full. And he's just so wildly bright. He's just got that mind. He's so quick. He's so bright. And his gift for comedy is this. He's a national treasure, you know. And I think he had fun. I know he was very nervous, and he spoke into this. He said no at first, and was like, "Are you crazy?" And she convinced him, and he decided to do something like wildly radical. And we had such, you know, we had a really really fun time. And he also drove me crazy in those scenes because he's not helping her. He's not helping her. He's actively kind of. There's so much contempt between them at the end. And to Mary and I, it's really the love story of the film. It's obviously never transgressive, but they are at the bitter end of this relationship. And when he breaks up with her effectively and ends this patient, client-doctor relationship, the movie's over. 10 minutes later, like that's when she goes completely off the rails and ends up, you know, throwing herself in the ocean. And so he's her last reflection of reality. He is the last one that she's allowed into her life.
There is a moment between Linda and Conan's character that really took me by surprise. I've seen the movie a couple of times now, and the second time I got to see it on my computer, so I had subtitles.
Yeah.
And I went back and I rewatched it. It's a moment when they're in a room together and he leaves and Linda says something under her breath. And it sounds like I love you. And I went back and I checked with the subtitles and it is I love you.
Yeah.
What? I mean, that's astonishing, that scene. What's going on there?
I know. It's so, I just thought it's so comically tragic, like tragically comic rather. And it just allows a window into her delusion as well. I mean, the whole film is a window into her, but really in that moment you see how far she's gone in her mind with this relationship, that she's let that slip out, this tiny, this thing that you just feel so uncomfortable and you're like, oh no, honey, don't.
And we don't know whether hears her, but there's this.
Yeah, and it's even more awkward because you're like, did he hear her? Did he not hear her? But capturing this moment of just absolute, when those moments in your life, when you say and the deep reveal of what's you actually think is the reality of this relationship, and it's just not. And it like so the and also the humor in that moment too, I think is really. For me, I took that away as well.
You mentioned throwing yourself into the ocean. Now, I'm guessing September, October 2023, it was fucking freezing.
So you would, that's a fair estimate. It was actually warm.
Oh,
that
okay.
was the grace. Yeah, the water. We were in Montauk in Long Island, and it was the end of the summer, like the very, very end. And it was so much like basically the whole schedule was around that. Like, when can we get there? Because if we don't get there by this time, we won't be able to shoot it. And the water was gorgeous. It was so warm, but it was rough. It was very rough. And that was scary. It was scary. We had a great team though. And a very, you know, a lot of, there for safety. And I had an extraordinary stunt double, but I did, 80% of it. So I think being an Australian, we have great respect for the ocean and you walk and swim at the same time. You really do. You have to learn to swim and walk at the same time. It's the same thing. So I think that lent itself subconsciously to the whole experience is that I just knew when the rip was coming or where it was coming and when to get out and when I didn't feel comfortable with it. Like in that sense of I'm not going to do something dangerous because I know I've been in a rip before in Australia and I've grown up there. So I think that lent itself to this, to my willingness to throw myself, my ability to do it. I was like, oh, I know how to what to look out for.
Bloody hell, you should get extra pay as a stunt person at this point as well.
Oh, it was such a beautiful sequence, though. Yeah. It felt there was such anticipation around shooting that sequence because it was just stunning. And I think it plays so beautifully at the end of the movie. It's quite breathtaking, that sequence.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. And the last thing I want to ask you is you're in town because you've been nominated for a BAFTA, which is taking place tomorrow night. Congratulations on that. And all the awards that you've won for this role as well. And of course, the Oscars coming up also. Conan is hosting the Oscars.
No, he's the host. Isn't that magic?
It is magic.
We've got to find out like who's done that before, because I'm sure it's happened before where there's been a host who's also been in a film. But it's just highly unlikely too, because Conan's never done a feature film before, you know, in a dramatic role. Definitely not. So I'm thrilled. I couldn't be more thrilled. I feel like I'm hosting because he's hosting.
Have you asked him to? I don't know, have a word? I mean, I don't know. Maybe he should recuse himself because he's in the pocket of...
I know. of this movie. but, I just hope that... what do I hope for? I hope to get some extra... Maybe the film... Maybe he can do some shout-outs for us on this. I hope he does a little... Some roasting of us would be fun. I just hope he refers to himself as a therapist. I hope there's some kind of referential note in him because it is... He's so funny in it and so wonderful, and I think it's really cool.
Amazing. Well, on that note, I'm going to let you go. I wish you all the best tomorrow night at the BAFTAs and at the Oscars as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. Amazing. Take care.
Thanks, Rose. Okay, that was Rose Byrne talking about If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, which is in cinemas now and is well worth your time, folks. And next up, Hello, Sydney. That was my attempt to be Ghostface. Terrible. Sorry. Anyway, yes, it's Neve Campbell who returns to the Scream series in this week's Scream 7. As the final girl to end all final girls, Sydney Prescott. Campbell, of course, was not in Scream 6, the first film in the franchise that she gave a swerve to. But she's back now, anchoring a new chapter, which, after a false start that saw stars Melissa Barrera and Jenna Ortega and director Christopher Landon leave the project under less than ideal circumstances, brings Kevin Williamson, who wrote the original Scream all the way back in 1996 for director Wes Craven, into the director's chair. For the first time, I went along and spoke to Neve just last week in a London hotel room and wanted to ask her about the legacy of this character and this franchise, about asking Kevin Williamson to direct it, about the great Wes Craven, of course, and much, much more. She was on great form. Hope you enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast by the star of Scream 7, Neve Campbell. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm very, very good indeed, I have to say. And I spoke to Kevin Williamson, about a month ago or so for Empire Magazine, and he was telling me about the time that you essentially asked him to direct this movie, and he said it was very emotional for him. He wasn't expecting it. He was blindsided a little bit. So talk me through your perspective on that.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, no, it was an honor to be able to ask him. I had had discussions with the studio. They had, you know, come to me and told me that they wanted to make a Sydney Prescott story this time around. And I was obviously intrigued and excited at the idea of that. And when we started having conversations about who the director should be, there was one person on the list. I mean, it didn't make sense to ask anybody else. And Kevin's always wanted to direct one of these. So I said, can I please be the one to ask him? I want to make that call. So we set up a Zoom and he didn't know what it was about. I think he probably thought it was going to be about script.
Yeah.
And I got to ask him. And and he was blindsided, and he was very quick to answer yes, and, you know, was in tears. And then I was in tears and we're both crying. It was great. It was a really lovely moment.
What were your exact words? How did you do it? Did you get down on one knee, but then you would disappear from the Zoom cameras?
Yeah, that would work on a Zoom.
Would you do me the honor of directing Scream 7?
Basically, I just said, you know, Kevin, we've all been having a discussion, and it doesn't make sense for anyone else to direct. Would you want to do that?
Amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, he might think about it. I'll get back to you. My people will call your people. And no, we'll see if we can make this happen.
It was quick. Yeah.
I have not, at the time that we were talking, seen this movie.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there are a lot of surprises in store. Yeah. Kevin did say that when the two of you first started talking about this movie and what you wanted this movie to do, that drawing back on the blood and gore was one of the things that you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then as time went on, you went.
Yeah. Pretty much. So it's funny because I did talk to him about that. And I was like, I feel like we've gone too far in one direction. I really, if we're going to do this together, can we make sure there's it's not as violent and not as gory? And he's like, yeah. And then I saw it 2 weeks ago and it's just as gory and bloody. How did that happen, Kevin? No, you know what? It's all the things we want from a Scream movie. It's got, I mean, it's intelligent and it's, we're back to Sydney, which is great, you know, to a character that we care deeply about. And I think we might be curious about now. And
yeah, very much
and
so.
And now we get to see her as a mom. In a way that we've never seen her before, which is lovely. And we get to see Isabel May, who plays Tatum, who is astounding. Like, she's just such a strong actor. She's got a lot of depth to her. And this character needs gravitas, you know? So they did such a good job casting her. And then, you know, just you get the humor and the witty and all the things we want. It's fun. I had a moment of, okay, I've asked Kevin and yeah, he's the best choice. And then I was like, oh God, I really hope he's the best choice. You know, fingers crossed, everything crossed. And then I saw it a couple of weeks. I had been in the edit quite a bit with him. But I saw the final cut a couple of weeks ago and I was in tears.
At the end. Wow.
I was sitting next to him and I was like, I'm not crying. Not crying over a Scream movie. But
well, that's
just
the thing, I think.
It just reminded me so much of the first.
That's
was really nice. Well, I feel like we finally got back to what we love about that.
Well, because I'm a big fan of the franchise, and I think one of the things that sets Scream aside from most other quote unquote slasher franchises is that you care about the characters.
Yeah.
So, you know, when in Scream 2, Randy, spoiler for Scream 2, everyone, Randy gets killed, it really hits home.
Yeah.
When my boy Dewey got killed in Scream, brackets 2022, that hurt.
That really hurt. It still hurts.
It still hurts.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that sets this franchise aside. For you, you've been involved with this from the beginning. Mm. What's the Scream death that's most hurt you? You can't talk about this movie, obviously.
I think it's got to be Dewey. I just, you know, there was only three of us who'd gotten that far.
Yeah.
And you know, to do that many films together, you really, you come to love these characters. And he's just such an adorable, wonderful, kind, funny character. And David himself as well is all of those things and his quirkiness. And he's just, he's got a bit of something that everybody can relate to.
Yeah.
I think. And so it was painful. I'm still pissed off about it.
Yeah, I spoke to David afterwards. I know he wasn't
particularly happy either.
But.
Well, it's like a death. I mean, it is a death
as
an actor when you have to say goodbye to a character.
Yeah.
And you thought you might get to play it again. And then suddenly you're like, oh, I'm never going to see them again. They're actually gone. It's hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I obviously know movies are shot out of chronology. Mm-hmm. But in a way, when someone dies on a Scream movie, are they gone? Does everyone come around and watch the death scene and give him a big, you know, death gift gift at the end? Or
no, not necessarily. I think if you're around, you know, if you're shooting that day, you would go witness that for sure.
Yeah.
But no.
Okay.
That'd be kind of weird and creepy.
Yeah, I was going to say.
A lot of pressure for the actor too, so.
Yeah, that would be very, very strange. Yeah. It has, of course, been well documented. You know, you weren't in the last movie. You weren't in Scream 6, and it's been well documented. Exactly what happened there, but not being part of it as it came out, was looking at it from the outside in, was that tough for you? And is this something that you, if Scream 7 happens, I'd like to be back
it
in that?
It was tough when I knew they'd started shooting.
Yeah.
It was not when it came out. At that point, I'd let it go. But it was tough knowing that these people were going into this playground that I love, you know, and that I wasn't there. But it still felt like the right choice. I knew that I couldn't walk onto that set and like myself very much or respect myself very
absolutely.
Much for where, what I'd been offered at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Fair play to you, indeed.
Yeah.
And you're talking here about, you know, loving this playground and loving Sydney. Mm-hmm. And of course, this was beyond your wildest dreams, I'm guessing, when you first stepped onto the set of the first movie with Wes, you know, all those years ago. At what point, you know, you didn't even know there was going to be a Scream 2, which obviously happened very, very quickly. But at what point did you really fall in love with not just Sydney, but Scream?
The whole, I mean, the script, reading the script for the first time, you know, it's so rare. Not that I'd read that many scripts at that age. I had On Party of Five and stuff, but yeah. But I still knew that it was special. I still knew there was something really special and new and exciting about this project. And then getting there to Santa Rosa and being with these really interesting actors, you know, who all were kind of crazy and energetic and fun and funny and talented. And then Wes, this like gazelle walking around, like, it was a surreal experience in this beautiful town. And it really was like summer camp. You know,
right,
we were all really new in our careers. You know, nobody was famous yet. Drew was, but the rest of us, Courtney.
She was gone by that point anyway, you know.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, exactly. And first year of Friends, first year of Party of Five, like it was all very new for us. You know, Courtney was a bit more famous than any of us. But yeah, so just special.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. Did I know? I didn't know. There was no way to know.
You couldn't know until it came out. And then suddenly it was this huge film.
No, and even when it came out, I was so clueless at the time. I remember seeing the numbers at the first, and I didn't know what numbers were. And the second weekend, my agents called me, and they all called me as a team, and I'd never had my team call me. And I thought, oh shoot, what have I done? What did I do? Am I in trouble? Are they letting me go? And they're like, Nev, we have to talk to you. And I was like, okay. They're like, it did this number. And I was like, oh no, is that bad? And they're like, no, it's really good. Like, these numbers are really good. I just was clueless. Probably a good thing that I was clueless, to be honest. And then, yeah, it just kept going and going and going.
You barreled straight into, again, talking to Kevin about this. I mean, Scream 2 came out a year later, and you know, he said he doesn't really remember writing it.
Oh, really? Wow.
But you could have fooled me because I love that movie, and it's absolutely brilliant. But barreling straight into that, was there a sense of the momentum carrying you a little bit into that film as well?
Gosh, that time was such a crazy time. I was shooting 10 months on Party of Five every year on film, 15 to 16 hour days, and then trying and then having 2 weeks off at Christmas. And for that other month and a half left or whatever, for 2 months, trying to make a movie, you know, so that I could establish myself as something other than Julia on Party of Five. That was important to me. But I had, you know, done Party of Five, gone straight into Wild Things, and then straight into Scream. And so it was... I think that's right. Yeah, that's right on the timing. So it was overwhelming. But at that time, when you're that young and these things are happening to you, you don't know what's normal and not normal, you know? But I was excited. I liked Sydney, and I was excited to explore her again. And, you know, I was barely making anything on that film because they'd negotiated me in the first.
Really?
Yeah, Courtney hadn't. She was getting paid, but I was not. You know, that number, because I was a nobody. You know, I was still, even though I was in this movie, they'd done so well, I was sort of still a nobody.
But you pointed at the poster, but that's me on the front of the poster.
That's weird.
Yeah, you know, cough up, please.
Doesn't work that way.
Not exactly.
If you've already signed something.
Unbelievable. Mm. But yeah, this has been, you know, just an amazing journey for you over the last 30 years now, I guess, with this character. We've talked about, you know, some of the great actors that you've interacted with. Do you remember your first interaction with Ghostface, the first time you were chased by him? Or, and I guess it wasn't Matthew or Skeet always in the costume.
No, not always.
Because I know on the last couple for Radio Silence, for those guys, Tyler and Matt, it was important for them for a lot of the times, the actors who were Ghostface, to actually be in the costume.
Yeah.
But wasn't necessarily the case for Wes, I'm guessing.
Yeah. No, we've had different stunt guys.
Yeah,
you also want the speed and you want the fighting ability, and you also don't want your actors to get hurt.
Yeah.
And people trip in that thing a lot.
I'm surprised that Ghostface gets so much done.
I know.
Because that's a big old cloak.
It's difficult.
Yeah. Very quiet as well for someone who wears DMs.
I know. You know, totally.
Clumping around. But yeah. So do you remember your first experience?
I'm not sure I remember. I think it was probably a chase sequence out the house.
Okay.
Possibly jumping over a fence.
Had you any idea what he was going to look like at that point?
I remember seeing Wes decide on the mask. They had a mask that they had found in a shop, and it was inspired by that. But then they decided to hone it. And so I remember him sitting with three different masks that all looked similar, but not exactly the same. And he and the props guys and the designers making a decision. Yeah. And Ghostface was born, which is crazy. And it really is an amazing mask. It is haunting, isn't it?
Yeah. Psychotic. Absolutely. Yeah. Iconic. When was the first time you heard Roger's voice? Was that on set at all?
Yeah, on set. I never met Roger, not until Scream 3.
Oh, wow.
Wes made sure that I didn't meet him. So he hid him like behind one of these black tarps, somewhere off set with a phone. Uh-huh. And so I would only act with him through the phone. That voice is iconic and incredible. Like, and Roger Jacks, so he's just such a sweet little old man, and wonderful and so playful with that character. And yeah, I remember being quite daunted, which is exactly what you want.
Absolutely. Yeah. have you ever, in your various phone conversations with the many ghost faces mm-hmm. that Sydney has bested over the years, have you ever just improvised with him and just gone off script and just started riffing?
Those lines are pretty tight.
Yeah.
But sometimes prior to a scene nowadays, because I'm a little more relaxed about it, I might have a little conversation prior to action.
A little loosener.
How you doing? What'd you have for lunch?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I think if Sydney just talked to Ghostface,
it might be okay. They might get along.
They might find things in common.
They might. They've never actually asked much more than what your favorite scary movie and fuck you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What do you like? I like chasing people with a knife. I like not being chased with a knife. So
I like
maybe,
running, though. We could run together. Let's go for
absolutely.
A joke.
Yeah, great cardio. It'd be fantastic. I just want to ask very, very quickly, because I've got to let you go, but about working with Wes. I mean, he directed the first four movies.
Yeah.
I had the pleasure of talking to him on a number of occasions, obviously before he passed. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Yeah.
So, so smart. What was your experience like with him?
Exactly that. I mean, he was so, so smart. I mean, he was a professor prior to being a director. And I don't know. He did walk like a gazelle on set. He was so graceful, this tall, lean, bearded man, and had such a twisted sense of humor, but was really gentle and astute and cared a lot about his crew. I think it's so important, the person at the top. I mean, it really is that trickle down.
Yeah.
If they're being kind and they're being generous and they're being conscious and they care about the work, then everyone else will do the same.
And did you see in Kevin a little bit of Wes, or was Kevin very much his own
completely.
Person?
No. I mean, Kevin was on set, the first set, almost every day.
Yeah.
And I don't think he realized it as a 32-year-old baby writer that the writer's not supposed to be on set. And, most directors, like, off you go. I'm not interested. You know, you're done. It's my job now.
Yeah.
But Wes was so gracious with him, like, gave him all kind. You know, Kevin was there. What are you going to do with that? Why are you doing that? And he listened and he shared his wisdom. And so Kevin took all of that. And that's why, look at his career now for the last 30 years has just been amazing. And a lot of that is what he's taken from what he learned.
Absolutely. Including buckets of blood.
Buckets of blood.
Buckets of blood.
He told me the other day that he actually just randomly, whenever he thinks of a death, he takes notes, he writes them down. Oh, that'd be a fun way to die. That's a creative way to die. And he has notes in his phone, or maybe it's a book, but he definitely has a list of just interesting ways to die. If that doesn't say something about Kevin Williams.
I can see that. I can see a sort of creepy serial killer's wall charts with lots of red string knocking around. I can see that.
Isn't that
absolutely.
Weird? I was like, Kevin, what?
Have you seen this notebook?
No. Maybe I should.
Maybe you shouldn't.
Maybe I shouldn't.
Maybe you shouldn't. And on that note, Nev Campbell, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Nev Campbell talking about Scream 7, which is in cinemas from tomorrow, Thursday, February 26th. And that's day and at Horror Film 5, shall we, folks? Corin Hardy's Whistle, in which a group of teenagers are picked off one by one, not by a masked ghost-faced killer, but by death itself after they blow an ancient death whistle that summons their future deaths to track them down, has been in cinemas a couple of weeks now, and Corin was kind enough to come into the pod booth on two separate occasions to record an absolute beast of a spoiler special interview with me, clocking in at around 90 minutes or so. That is up now on our spoiler special subscription feed, but if you don't subscribe and are on the fence about doing so, well, here's 20 minutes or so of that interview that may tip you over the edge in a nice direction. hopefully. Remember, this is a spoiler special interview, so do not listen to it unless you've seen Whistle. We spoil shit from the off. Enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on this spoiler special for Whistle by the film's director, Corin Hardy. How are you, sir?
I'm here. I'm happy. Nice to see you.
You've made it.
Yeah. A little bit hairy on the way, but...
Yeah, your future death hasn't tracked you down yet.
It was trying.
That we know of.
Yeah, it was trying. We took a detour. Cheated it.
There's so much to talk about with this movie. Before we get into it properly, Corin is drinking, what is it, an Earl Grey tea you're drinking
Earl
at the moment?
Earl Grey tea, no sugar, tiny little bit of milk.
All right, okay.
Is that okay?
No, it's totally fine.
Stop slurping?
No, it's fine. Well, yeah, maybe that. Maybe stop doing that particular noise.
Doing that.
But, so before, oh, Jesus Christ, he's just placed in Choca itself, Louis, the Aztec death whistle from the movie, staring directly at me.
I have to bring it everywhere since making a film. It feels like my co-pilot of this movie.
If you listen to our live show, the Corin was on episode 700 from a couple of months ago now, you'll know that you bring this everywhere with you, like the nuclear football in America. You have it chained to your wrist at all times because this thing's too dangerous to
exactly
let out.
Can't be, you know, putting some unfortunate person's hands.
You had a hand in designing this, didn't you?
Yeah. I had a hand in it. I worked a lot with a brilliant Spanish concept artist, Daniel Carrusco. Mm-hmm. And we went back and forth on about 50 different looks to get to where it got to, which is something that could hold up to, you know, extreme close-ups and be like the lead character opposite Daphne and Sophie and the gang.
Yeah.
And as well as like feel, I want it to feel really sort of sacred and historical and ancient and like it had been passed through hundreds, if not thousands, of pairs of hands and been responsible for lots of perishment.
Which is a brand new word that Corin Hardy has coined for this movie, and rightly so, because there are a lot of perishments in this movie. did you want it to exude a sense of evil, or did you want it to be neutral?
Well, if I had a way of controlling the light in here, then you can change that. And what I wanted was to exactly balance. Well, that's sort of flat lighting. Chris had just turned the lights on very bright. And then if you turned them all out and you had a little light underneath it, it can look very malign.
Oh, yeah.
It can look vacant. I wanted it to look like almost like something that was ignoring you at some times and something that was extremely powerful and domineering over, you know, presiding over the unfolding carnage.
And visually, did you want it to be, how much of a presence did you want it to be in the movie?
It had to be a presence in the movie. Yeah, it had to be, it had to feel like it could hold up. I mean,
it's not there for every death, though. It's not that necessarily. It doesn't appear when people die.
No, it doesn't appear, but it's sort of, it needs to both be something that lures you in and makes you need to blow it in order to get you to carry out this sort of, you know, encroaching death. And anyone that hears it, their deaths are going to come as well. So, yeah, it was trying to capture something which I wanted it to feel iconic, like a new sort of horror, iconic horror character in its own right and hold up on a poster. And, you know, we'll cut to it. I mean, it's a bit like, the doll in Annabelle. It never moves. It's static.
Mm.
But just by pushing in on it, you get this sense that it's aware of everything that's going on around it. So whilst it can't change its expression, there was an early idea that I wanted to make like 5 or 6 different sort of expressions, so very subtly different. But we sort of achieved that with lighting.
Yeah. Yeah,
as well.
It's interesting because it does whisper to people. So we hear it whisper to Chris. Yeah. We hear it whisper to the girl at the end of the movie as well.
And Craven,
And Craven, it doesn't spell out the T's and C's, though, does it? it basically says
it's fast American at the bottom.
Yeah, maybe it does.
Yeah.
By the way, perishment will continue. Perishment will result as a result of this.
We recorded, like every actor recorded their own whispers, screams, backwards. The whispers that are all mixed into different layers in the film are even kind of meaningful in what they're saying. So Chris is hearing her dad's voice calling out to her.
Right,
And, you know, like almost anything that would seduce you into it, getting you to blow into it. So yeah, we recorded everyone as well doing dialogue. What I did is they learned the line, then we recorded it, played it back backwards, got them to record it backwards, and then played it back forwards. So you'd get this really odd tone of voice of each of those actors whispering to themselves in reverse.
Just
to kind of, you know, create this strange unnerving. So there's lots of different layers in the sound of it.
It's really interesting because I've seen the movie twice now. And yeah, second time around, something occurred to me that hadn't occurred to me first time around, which is, correct me if I'm wrong here, Karin, is everybody who gets killed in this movie, they all play the spectre who's hunting them down, or are you using doubles? Grace, for example, when Grace is being chased through the maze, mm-hmm, is she chasing herself, or is that a double?
So in terms of the concept, obviously they are being hunted down by themselves
yeah,
but in a different guise, the guise of their own fate, however they end up. And that required, it's funny, on paper, on script, you know, you just go, okay, you know, that would be them hunting themselves down in some visual way. But actually, each death required a lot of different techniques, both with sort of practical effects and puppetry and prosthetics and animatronics and visual effects. But the actual deaths of themselves, frequently they would play themselves in some shots for some, for whatever the reason.
Their future selves.
But they would also, their future deaths, like being visited, yeah, and because they also get sort of visitations ahead, yeah, of their actual facing their own death. I think it's like when death is, Ivy Ramos says, when your death is close, and it's like you'll see it afar. It will be down the end of the corridor, or it will be outside your window on a tree, or it will be down the end of the sort of on the other side of the swimming pool. Mm. But then gradually come the time, it's when it actually physically connects with you that it gives you its death. At that point, depending on how you end up, we're on a spoiler special, so we can
of course
talk,
we are, yeah.
So, you know, beginning with Mason Raymore, whose probable death happens in, I think they say he died when he was 40 or mid-40s, and of some kind of gas leak. So this guy probably perished in a house fire. So his burnt self is what comes to pass its death onto him at the beginning of the movie.
Mm.
But a lot of the time, that their death would have to be played by a double, either a creature performer double, because of certain movements or contortion movements or makeup requirements, because a lot of creature performers have an incredible physicality to them, and
yeah,
they have like very long and slender necks and you know, much sort of slimmer faces or longer arms, because when you're putting prosthetics on them, you end up building that out a little bit. And if you have someone who's already, you know, a regular sort of build, they can look like a bulky, you know, you want them to look like a burnt man or a cancerous character who's lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
It's harder,
yeah,
to do that. So yeah, for the burnt man, we had a creature performer called Matt, who actually played Mason's double as the burnt man. And he also played Percy Hines White's Noah Haggerty's death at the end.
Oh, right. Okay.
So he played two. We also had two performers playing Grace as the crone. So we had Kaylee and Toria. Kaylee was a dancer and Toria was a contortion artist.
Yeah.
So for different shots in the maze and for Grace's crone self hunting herself down, the ancient sort of aged and very senile death, who's kind of like the crazy old lady version, yeah, of Grace. For different shots, it was two different actresses in full body prosthetics with contact lenses and everything else, because Toria could do, you know, these incredible contortions, and she could hang upside down and drop down on her.
Oh,
she could,
right,
she
okay,
could, you know, stand up backwards. But you know, it's also incredibly demanding, so it's helpful to have two.
Mm.
Daphne, so Daphne as Chris, she played her own death, particularly for close-ups.
Yeah.
But then we also had another two actresses playing her death as well. Naomi, who is a stunt performer who could do... Naomi and Jen, I think, were two stunt performers. And again, it sort of breaks down when you look at the storyboards for like the exact requirements. So if you look at the end sequence when Daphne Keane is is playing Chris, grappling with her death in the in-between zone, as it was called, the sort of in-between life and death.
Yeah.
She's on wires. She's suspended in you know, in a space that we were shooting in a studio, making it look like it was underwater.
Oh, wow.
Which was a, you know, big challenge to kind of create a sense of being underwater when we weren't in any tank.
So you honestly could have fooled me. I thought you were. I was about to ask about that.
Massive, yeah, I mean, we're jumping around, but yeah, huge, huge tribute to Bjorn Charpentier, the DOP, who spent a long time figuring out how to make the most, you know, successful looking, although we're not actually, we're in an in-between zone between life and death, as opposed to in a real swimming pool or something. But we wanted to go for that underwater feel. So that was a case of using lots of high-powered fans, shooting in you know, fast frame rate, so it looks slow motion, using controlled different lights that are pulsing and changing, and yeah, going back to the actress, then you'd have Daphne Keane in the close-ups and in the wide shots against a made-up double of herself playing Chris's death. And then when you swap the angle, Daphne Keane is done up as her death, grappling against her double. If you look at the credits, you'll see a lot of stunts and creature performers, because there's two to three playing each one of these characters in their deaths for different reasons.
That's amazing.
That started to scramble my head just trying to remember. But it became quite daunting when you were like, well, you know, which death is it? What stage is it? Which character is it? Do they have contact lenses or not contact lenses? You know, do they need to be on wires or do they need to be, you know... And actually, Matt, who played the burnt man, also played Dean's death in the Dean's death bedroom scene.
Oh, really? Okay.
As well as Twisty Troy, who played Dean's contortion death double.
Oh, my. Twisty Troy.
Twisty Troy, who's incredible. And he's been in a lot of great movies. He's in Andrei Overdahl's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. You'll see him in that as the Jingly Jangly Man, I think he's called.
Wow. His name's Twisty or Twisty?
Twisty. Twisty Troy.
Wow. Mm. Very nominative determinism at work.
And he can, as well as Toria, they can, you know, it's like their bones are made of rubber almost. They can just get into some insane positions.
You talked about the opening death there, and you and I had spoken about this movie for the magazine, but and I obviously knew that I knew the basic concept, but I didn't know how the deaths were going to manifest themselves. And I was going in and I was wondering, is this going to be Final Destination-y in a way? I was waiting for an elaborate Omen-style accident to befall Mason in that opening scene. And then when he burst into flames out of nowhere, I was stunned. I did not know what the hell was going on. And then, of course, you explain it later on.
Actually,
can you talk about establishing the rules of Inchoka and parsing it out through the film?
Yeah.
Well, leaving that air of mystery, I guess, as well.
I think, first of all, the thing which both struck me about the idea in the mythology of when you hear the whistle scream, your future death will hunt you down, which was a really like exciting, sort of simple, elegant, scary mythology concept. But it's different to something like Final Destination in a subtle but important way, I think. In Final Destination, they cheat death, and a form of death will find its way to get them in a really elaborate, exciting way, depending on where they are in the environment. You know, it's almost like the environment is part of that. It's not tied into their personal fate that is sort of in Whistle. It's very specific, as Ivy Ramos says, you know, when you are born, so is your death.
Yeah.
And this was something that Owen explained early on that made me get a little chill down my spine.
Owen Edgerton, the writer.
Owen Edgerton, Was the sort of deeper, you know, conversation about mortality and this idea that, you know, we are all going to die. We don't know when. And it could be in a week's time. It could be in 90 years' time. But the idea that your death is out there waiting for you.
Mm.
And if you blow on Inchoka and you hear it scream, it pulls that death to come to face you in the next couple of days or tomorrow or tonight. That was kind of chilling. And then it sort of, that determines the specificity of what your death is and how it's then going to materialize, which is great. But what is harder in a movie like this is you don't do the Final Destination thing where you show the situation that they all nearly died in.
Yeah.
And then they suddenly cheated it. And then, you know, death comes for them in a different way. So we had to effectively sort of set up this concept where you don't know exactly how these people die and then sort of drip feed in through these visitations visually that these characters start to see almost like premonitions of what their future death will be. But we don't want to give it away.
Yeah.
We don't want to give it away, but we want to set it up so that my main concern was that we'd never be in a death sequence and not know what the hell's going on. Except maybe the first one, which is fine because, you know, you don't know. And then they talk later as like, oh, they do some research and say, oh, he found out he was killed in a gas leak. And so Mr. Craven, you know, he died of stage 4 cancer, but they're sort of like, yeah, but like 10 or 15 years, but not yesterday, you know, like when it was fine, but he's obviously, so they all have hints, you know, Craven.
No, I like the air of mystery, but I like that it wasn't what I was expecting it to be, which was a series of unfortunate accidents befalling these poor souls, and of course each death scene as well is accompanied by, and I really got this yesterday because I saw it on the big screen,
great,
by this crunching whistle, almost musical motif.
Oh, good.
That accompanies it. Well heard. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, love to. I mean, again, tribute to Doomphonic, the composer, and who is very kind of classically trained in you know, the John Williams school of thematic scoring and characters having themes. And we knew early on, inspired by the likes of, you know, Michael Myers' and Halloween theme or Jaws theme or character themes within movies, that we definitely wanted the whistle itself to have its own. It's kind of almost like a victory theme of when it achieves, when it finally gets you.
Yeah.
It takes your life, it gives you its death, and there is a repeating kind of motif in that, which is a bit like a ticking clock catching up to get you and then kind of like being. And it actually changed because in early cuts, we had a slower kind of quite bold. It was like a kind of boom, 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 bow, like the whistle did it. And now it's got this kind of like, you know, kind of. So it's a sort of an earworm. I mean, it's not quite as sort of musical that it's a jingle.
Yeah, no,
but it is a death jingle, I guess. I suppose I wanted to inject a certain energy into the overall movie that ties in with the sort of soundtrack of bands a bit and the, you know, influences on there, and you hear some Prodigy in there and some of the electronic stuff that helps sort of the kinetic momentum of the experience of the movie in the cinema. So it kind of it isn't a sort of slow paced, it has tension and mood and everything, but it's almost like there's a slight kind of celebration when the whistle achieves its next victim.
And that was Corin Hardy spoiling the shit out of Whistle, which is in cinemas right now, folks. And if you want to hear the rest of that interview, there's well over an hour left. And if you want to subscribe to the Empire Podcast spoiler specials, it is just £3.49 a month. And that gives you access to every single spoiler special we've done. And that number is growing all the time and by the week. We're at about 500 now, with hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of content, including interviews with some of the greatest directors on the planet just waiting to be discovered. Go to empire.supportingcast.fm for more details and, of course, to sign up. And with that very shameless plug, that is it for this episode of The Interviews. Well, bar two more very shameless plugs, one of which is for The Shameless Plug, another spin-off show in which I sit down with Empire editor Nick Desimlian and do a deep dive into the new issue of Empire magazine. That's going up tomorrow, Thursday, and then on Friday, in fact every Friday, we have the regular Empire podcast featuring myself, Helen O'Hara, James Dyer, and Mike Munzer making his full Empire debut this week. We'll also have an interview on that with the Testament of Anne Lee's star-director combo, Amanda Seyfried and Mona Fassfault, available wherever you cast your pods. Right, that is enough for me. We'll be back next week with another cracking episode of The Interviews. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.